طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
And welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is produced by Despina Moutsouris. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this morning with a plea from Palestinian women for protection living in occupied East Jerusalem. The plea was sent to us by our friend and colleague, Hitam Adelby, who is an expressive therapist who lives in East Jerusalem and is witness to the horrors being inflicted on the Palestinian community by the Israeli military and the Jewish settlers who are illegally expropriating Palestinian land. The statement which I am about to read was written by the Jerusalemite Women's Coalition, which includes women from non-governmental organizations, NGOs, and Jerusalemite feminists from all segments of the society. The statement sent throughout the international community reads, "We women of occupied East Jerusalem call for the immediate protection as we witness and suffer the widespread and serious violations of Palestinian human rights, including physical attacks and injuries, severe psychological threats, and persecution by the Israeli settler colonial state and settler entities. We urge the international community to act and defend the rights of Palestinian children, women, and men, including the right to a safe life amidst the constant attacks, excessive and indiscriminate use of force used by the Israeli oppressive apparatus, acts of violence and daily terror committed by Israeli Jewish civilians, including settlers. This brutality is intimidating our lives, provoking our youth, willfully causing death and bodily and psychological harm, and disabling and injuring of our community members. We, a group of Palestinian women, mothers, sisters, daughters, and youth, and in the name of the Jerusalemite Women's Coalition, call upon the international community to protect our families, community, and children. We are calling for the protection of our bodily safety and security when in our homes, walking in our neighborhood, reaching schools, clinics, workplaces, and worship venues. We are calling for protection, for we feel displaced even at home as the Israeli soldiers, armed settlers, border patrol, and police invade our homes, attack our families, strip search our bodies, and terrorize us all. We women of occupied East Jerusalem feel as if we are orphans without any protection from the Palestinian Authority or the international community, as the Israeli state terrorizes our homes, educational institutions, and public spaces. The state's imposition of collective punishment and sanctions invade not only our physical spaces and bodies, but also our psyches. We live in a state of fear and horror, not knowing how to face the omnipotent power of the highly technologized settler community and militarized Israel state that regularly executes Palestinians in the streets. Palestinians in occupied East Jerusalem have been abandoned, subject to the discriminatory policies of a violent state and its security and police apparatus. We are calling to protect women and girls who are particularly vulnerable to various forms of state violence and mass atrocities. The economic strangulation of Palestinians by the Israeli settler community powers that have thus far resulted in the total dependency on the Israeli entity further traps the lives of Palestinians. The feminization of poverty and the economic strangulation of Palestinians in occupied East Jerusalem enslave Palestinians. The feminization of slavery in the colony is apparent when watching Palestinian women turn into domestic workers, humiliated, controlled, and oppressed in Israeli public and private entities. We are aware that humanitarian law attempts to challenge the inherent inhumanity of wars and colonial criminality by requiring international actors to protect civilians. International humanitarian law suggests moral boundaries of the exercise of power in situations of mass violence. International humanitarian law's main object is primarily to protect and aid victims of violence. We, the women of occupied East Jerusalem, are politically orphaned. We are victims without protection, as the Palestinian Authority has no right to protect us in our city, and the Israeli state treats us as terrorists that should be humiliated, attacked, violated, and controlled. The guerrilla state-style tactics used in occupied East Jerusalem, be it the attacks on Palestinians in the streets, the beating of the young and old, the attacks on children going to and from school, the invasion of violent settlers to our neighborhoods and homes, the control of our life, water, cell phones, internet, mobility, health, economy, and accessibility to other resources have situated us in human cages, segregated, restrained by Israeli laws and security theology, unable to know what to anticipate and what will come next. Having to endure all the above difficulties, which have been escalated by Israeli cabinet resolutions and otherwise ignored due to global amnesia, we are calling for protection and urgent actions to prevent further agonies, uprooting, demonizations, and suffering. Signed by Jerusalemite Women's Coalition. That was a statement describing the conditions under which Palestinians are living as Israel increases its strangulation of East Jerusalem. It is a plea to the international community for protection because it is not coming from the Palestinian Authority or the international community. Jonathan Cook, the British journalist who writes out of Nazareth, puts that plea by Palestinian women and the current situation in Palestine into perspective in the following incredibly insightful article in Mondo Weiss. He writes, "Among Palestinians and Israelis, the recent upsurge in violence has been variously described as the children's lone wolf, Jerusalem, and smartphone intifadas. Each describes a distinguishing feature of this round of clashes. The steady erosion of Fatah and Hamas authority during the post-Oslo years, as the Palestinian factions proved incapable of protecting their people from the structural violence of the occupation, has driven Palestine's politically orphaned children to the streets armed with stones. The growing hopelessness and sense of abandonment have led a few so-called lone wolves to vent their fury on Israelis with improvised weapons such as knives, screwdrivers, and cars. These attacks have attracted the most publicity, becoming the equivalent of the Second Intifada's suicide bomber. But they serve chiefly as a barometer of Palestinian despair. Jerusalem is the center of events, with the Palestinians' only unifying symbol, Al-Aqsa Mosque, at its heart. For Palestinians, the incremental takeover of the compound and the West's indifference is like watching the mass dispossession of 1948 play out again in slow motion. In addition, Jerusalem is the main fault line. Israel's illegal annexation of the city has left Palestinians there in an extreme form of isolation, indefinitely stateless and supremely vulnerable. And finally, the smartphone camera has allowed Palestinians to document their suffering and witness unmediated their compatriots' personal acts of resistance and self-sacrifice. Futile knife attacks may appall outsiders, but for many Palestinians, they are the moment when an individual briefly reclaims his or her agency and fights back on behalf of a collectively subjugated and humiliated people. The need for so many different labels for these events reveals another important facet of the current Palestinian struggle, its disorganized nature. Israel has almost completed the division and enclosure of Palestinians into disconnected enclaves. As they hear the sound of the prison doors closing, Palestinian youths are lashing out at the guards closest at hand. Because the divisions between Palestinian populations have become so entrenched geographically and their leaders politically, it is hard for Palestinians to find any unifying vision or organizing principle. Do they fight first against their occupiers or their spent leadership? But the lack of planning and discipline has exposed Israel's own limitations, too. Israel has little but stopgap measures to defend against the protests. Its intelligence agencies cannot predict the lone wolf, its guns cannot deter the knife, its military might cannot subdue the craving for justice and dignity. Strangely, in the face of all this, there are signs of a parallel breakdown of order and leadership on the Israeli side. Mobs of Jews patrol Jerusalem and Israeli cities, calling out, "Death to Arabs!" A jittery soldier causes pandemonium by firing his rifle in a train carriage after a bogus terrorist alert. An innocent Eritrean asylum seeker is shot by a security guard during an attack because he looks Arab, then beaten to a pulp by a lynch mob that include soldiers. Meanwhile, politicians and police commanders stoke the fear. They call for citizens to take the law into their own hands. Palestinian workers are banned from Jewish towns. Israeli supermarkets remove knives from shelves, while 8,000 Israelis queue up for guns in the first 24 hours after permit rules are eased. Some of this reflects a hysteria, a heightened sense of victimhood among Israelis, fueled by the knife attack videos. But the mood dates to before the current upheavals. There's also a sign of the gradual leaching of the settlers' lawlessness into the mainstream. A popular slogan from the past week is, "The army's hands are tied." Israeli civilians presumably believe they must take up arms instead. After 6 uninterrupted years of the extreme right in power, Israelis don't blame their government's policy of relentless force for the backlash. They demand yet more force against the Palestinians. Polls show Avigdor Lieberman's, the former Moldovan bouncer, who became the hard man of the Israeli right, is most favored to lead the nation out of the crisis. Solutions are being applied, and most savagely in East Jerusalem, where Palestinians are being locked even more tightly into neighborhood ghettos. Israel's eternal unified capital is being carved up by roadblocks. Palestinian residents are made to endure daily searches and insults that will sow the seeds of yet more fury and resistance. As Israel tries to slam the door of one prison cell in Jerusalem, the inmates threaten to break open the door of another in Gaza. Israel's leadership has watched uneasily the repeated breaches of Gaza's fence over the past days by youths enraged by their own misery and what they see happening to the other prison wings. The current unrest may recede, but more waves of protest of even greater intensity are surely not far behind. Jafar Farah, a Palestinian leader in Israel, has warned of it heading slowly from a national conflict into civil war, one defined by the kind of debased one-state solution Israel is imposing. The chaotic violence of the past weeks looks like a warning from the future, a future Israel is hurtling towards. That was an article written by British journalist Jonathan Cook, writing from Nazareth. Our feature presentation is by Palestinian professor Mazen Kumsaya, biologist, geneticist, activist, and director of the new Museum of Natural History at Bethlehem University. We featured Professor Kumsaya last week, giving a presentation based on his book, Sharing the Land of Canaan. This week, we feature the second part of his presentation, which focuses on his work developing the Museum of Natural History at Bethlehem University and the role it plays in the resistance to occupation. This is just not any Museum of Natural History, but as you will hear, a lifeline to beauty and serenity in the midst of violence and war. This is a PowerPoint presentation which took place at Boston College, but even though our radio audience will not see the visuals, Professor Kumsaya talks us through and makes his points. Much of the following presentation is in the form of questions and answers, and the quality of the audio varies, but hopefully you will be able to follow the conversation. Here is Mazen Kumsaya talking about his Natural History Museum in Bethlehem.
Now I want to take a few minutes to tell you about the museum that we are building. It's a museum of natural history. Its mission includes research, education, and conservation. Our motto is respect for ourselves first, self-empowerment. I tell my students that, like they used to say in the 1950s in the civil rights movement, free your mind and your ass will follow. So really, I think that's the right way to think about it, because our ultimate chains is not the physical occupation. Our ultimate chains are here in our minds when we obey and we believe them, that we are somehow subhuman, or that they are better than us, or that they are a chosen people. If we start to believe that, then it's finished. You know, as Stephen Biko said, the best weapon in the hand of the occupier is the mind of the occupied. So we have to liberate our minds first. And then later we can respect others, and we can respect nature, of course, and protect nature. And it has been remarkably successful, actually, doing this with the students and empowering them. And they are able to do research like this on genotoxic effect of Israeli industrial settlements. This is Khulood Hamad, one of my master's students. We do studies like here on the environmental impact of the Israeli industrial and other settlements. Here you can see the settlement of Har Homa built on Jebel Abu Ghneim, what it looked like in 1997 on the top and what it looks like on the bottom. And so we publish a paper with some of my students here and others. There's a volunteer from Germany who came and volunteered with us, Sibella Zibala, on decline in vertebrate biodiversity in Bethlehem. Here's even undergraduate students publishing on scorpions, spiders, butterflies. We have a paper just submitted on butterflies, birds, reptiles, amphibians, etc. We also study Israel mega projects like the diversion of the water of the Jordan Valley that really devastated the environment, and now they are starting a new project to take water from the Red Sea to the Dead Sea, which will be even more environmentally catastrophic, destroying the land of the Wadi Araba area, etc. We have other challenges that we are working on, like desertification and climate change, where it's already risen in temperature and we already have a decline in water precipitation. We have, you know, so many challenges and water issues, not because we don't have enough water. We have plenty of water. It's just that there's unequal distribution. For example, you can see on the chart on the right that Israeli Jews get several fold more water than we have, and we are allowed to have less water than the World Health Organization recommends for healthy living. So we do various projects like permaculture, like school education about environmental conservation to solve the problems, the conundrums that the occupation colonization creates for us. We are doing various projects like biological controls, you know, and many research areas that we're doing, like human impact on the environment, geology, paleontology, genetics, etc. We also take care of animals, and we try to intensive agriculture with ecologically sensitive agriculture, no pesticides, insecticides used. We try to reach out to children very early age. For example, these kindergartens were learning about butterflies on the top right-hand corner, even dressed as butterflies to think how a butterfly thinks, if you want, and draw butterflies and, you know, learn by touching, by handling. The Chinese saying, I hear and I forget, I see and I remember, I do and I understand. So we want them to do things with their hands so that they understand. This is recycling trash and paper, so on. We even started producing things like honey in our museum ground in the botanical garden. And this adds to our income. And we rely on volunteers a lot. And these volunteers, we try to keep them happy. And we have many plans for the museum. But the museum in Bethlehem has become a mini oasis in the middle of Bethlehem. And to be honest, I would be in a mental institution if it was not for this work. Because I, with all these pressures that I mentioned to you earlier and so forth, if I didn't have this small oasis, which even started to attract wildlife in the middle of an urban area, Bethlehem. There is a fox family, for example, that lives on the museum grounds. There's a kingfisher who comes, hunts a fish in the pool that we constructed. But I go sit on the side of the pool and watch the birds and the insects and the butterflies and the dragonflies. And this to me is a form of psychotherapy because the stresses of the situation are so high. Questions? And you can ask me devil's advocate type of questions too. Go ahead.
I was just wondering, you're so into the ecological development and clearly are a one-stater, if you're part of or have seen especially productive projects about the intersection of those two things, like sort of imagining how a one-state solution would viably work with ecological changes and sort of reducing pollution or all of these things that have come about because of the occupation. So I'm just wondering if you know of any.
Yeah, I mean, in my first book about the Palestine question called Sharing the Land of Canaan, I have a section on sustainable development and the environment. And I argue in this chapter, I'm happy to share it with you if you want, I argue that really a two-state solution is impossible on that ground too, in addition to many other reasons why it's not going to work, that dealing with the environmental challenges that we have is requires us to live together. It's already, I mean, the Israeli and Palestinian populations are intermeshed. The natural resources are one and the same. The holy sites, you know, like Jerusalem area, etc., cannot be separated. So there are many reasons why it has to be in one country. It cannot be in two countries. Also because even having a small Palestinian country, so to speak, Palestine, if you want, in the West Bank and Gaza, even by miracle it can happen. It's really contrary to the idea of Zionism, and it will be nullified because Zionists cannot recognize Palestinian rights to anything, as water, let's say, for example. Palestinians in negotiations in Oslo, they tried to get the Zionists to say that Palestinians have a right to water. And the Zionists said, no, we can talk about your needs of water, but we cannot talk about your rights to water. Because if we talk about your rights to water, if we give you a right even to 1 cubic meter of water, that nullifies the Zionist project as a colonial project. If we say that Palestinians have a right to a square kilometer, a square mile in Ramallah only, they cannot say that. They cannot say we have a right to Ramallah. Because if they say that, what's the difference between saying we have a right to Ramallah and having a right to Jaffa and Haifa and Nazareth and all these places that we were kicked out of? So Zionism can never accept native rights for anything. Water, nature, air, environment, anything. And so it's incompatible with this kind of division of rights, so to speak. That's why it's also environmentally impossible to reconcile the notion of a two-state with the sustainable development or environmental things. So, yeah.
Do you foresee any challenges to the museum in the future? Where do you think the direction, future direction of the museum is going to go?
As you see, we have set a kind of ambitious goals here for the museum. 5 goals that are on the sheet. These goals are contrary, of course, to the idea of a Jewish state in Palestine. I mean, let's be frank about it, because any kind of existence of Palestinian, Christian, and Muslim, and their development, their, working on the environmental issues, working on cultural issues, working on educational issues, all of this is incompatible with the idea of Zionism, which says that basically the whole country is a Jewish state and Palestinians are unwanted. At best, they are residents without rights. So, of course, there's many challenges that we face. I mean, for example, you've seen there in the video like some pictured microscopes and equipment that we're doing actual laboratory work. This was not easy to get material to do this because everything has to go through Israel. And many times they try to prevent us. For example, as a geneticist, I need to use 99% or 100% alcohol. We're not allowed to have that. Precipitate DNA, for example. We're not allowed to have that. We're allowed to have 70% alcohol, which is used for sterilization, for regular whatever, but not 99% alcohol. Why? Because that's the way they say it. Security. Whatever. I don't know what you're going to do with 99% alcohol that you cannot do with 70% alcohol in terms of security. I mean, they're both flammable. So it's really a harassment. But I have to have 99% alcohol, so I get it. I get it and I smuggle it in, even. There are ways. When there is a will, there is a way. So there is a challenge. But as I tell my students again, as you heard me say it, if we use our minds, we can go over these obstacles. We can challenge these obstacles.
I was wondering how long the museum has existed, and I was also wondering where you got the funding for it.
Yeah. I actually have been studying animals and mammals since I did my PhD on mammals of the Holy Land, and we've been working, and I worked with some students, published some papers before we actually started the museum officially as a building, if you want, or as a site, as a garden, etc. The official site, we started on it about a year ago, in June, a year and 3 months ago, or 4 months ago, in June 2014, when I signed an agreement with Bethlehem University, my wife and I donated $250,000 over the first 4 years to get the museum going because we don't have any funding. And also I wanted to make sure, I suppose I could have set up as an NGO and went and sought some funding first But then you are dependent on the donors and what they want you to spend on and all of this stuff. No, I said, let's do it with our freedom, with our volunteers. And for the first few years where we set the agenda ourselves, what we want to work on, and so that's how I did it. And we rely on donations also from others, and people donate to us. I think this past 13, 14 months since we started. This is all, of course, under Bethlehem University, so donations go to Bethlehem University, but they are designated for the museum. I think I raised another $40,000-$50,000 from friends and colleagues and family members and others. And now we are beginning to submit for grant proposals, which is not an easy process also because of the way that we are. For example, USAID could fund me, but I'm not willing to submit to USAID because I have these unusual conditions where it says I cannot talk to anybody who belongs to what they list as terrorist organizations, Hamas, Fatah, military wing, Popular Front. Well, how am I going to check everybody I talk to, whether they belong to this faction or that faction in Palestine? Plus, I disagree with them on what they designate as terrorist organization and what they designate, for some, as somebody said, one's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. So I am not willing to sign that kind of agreement to get the money from USAID. European Union is under pressure, so we'll see. But I'm optimistic that we can find the funding for it. From various sources and contracts, especially on issues like agriculture, permaculture. There's a lot of interest in funding those kind of projects. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you for your talk. I learn more every time. First question is, I spoke a few days ago with a colleague of mine in Hebron, mm-hmm. Who works with a lot of young people, and he says that just so many of them want to die.
So many what?
So many of the young people he works with just want to die. They have no they feel they have no future, they don't know what they're working for. And the question is really with the move, extreme move to the right in Israeli politics. There's every reason to believe it'll get worse before it gets better. How do you keep the heads of young people in the game?
This is precisely why I think this museum is more important than ever, even in such circumstances. Because if you are building as if the occupation is not there, we're doing a natural history museum, a botanical garden, we're educating children about conservation of our environment, the climate change, etc. We're treating it as if there's no occupation. And this is important, I think, because it gives people a sense of there is something after this. It cannot continue forever that we are under occupation, colonization, killing, etc. I think it's an important antidote to the despair that exists. And the Zionists really don't understand this, and they think that keeping the pressure on people will force them to leave. Yes, it forces some people to leave. I mean, to be honest, my own brother, for example, was a professor at Bethlehem University, and he left. My sister now also lives in Utah, the Mormon. Yeah. But anyways, it's not religious persecution or economic pressures or anything like that. It's really the political pressures. The fact that, you cannot go to Jerusalem. For my sister, the only Mormon church was in Jerusalem. She cannot get to her church, what is she going to do? So she decided to come where she can practice her religion here. It is this kind of pressures that causes people to leave. Now, I think what we are trying to do in the process of building this museum is provide alternatives and provide a positive environment for people to grow and put their energy in a direction that's away from all this negative energy around us. It's putting a few positive charges in an atmosphere that's full of negative energy, and it produces a little bit of a space, if you want, for semi-normal development for children. And I see it in the children who come to the museum or the botanical garden when they see butterflies flying around them. It really, it makes a big difference. Then if they see Israeli soldiers preventing them from getting to school, you know. So it's an important normalizing effect, if you want. Maybe it's a hopeless gesture, but we try at least.
I think the problem is it's so much easier to do that in Bethlehem under your direction than to do it in Gaza, say. And so that there's still a whole population of young people that can be lost without enough Dr. Kunz's and...
Yeah. I have a colleague in Gaza who came back from Europe. He was working for the European Space Agency. He went back to Gaza. He also sacrificed, like I did. I sacrificed a 6-digit salary for a 2- or 3-digit salary. and he did the same thing. He left this good life in Europe, went back to Gaza, where he teaches 1 or 2 courses at the university. But he brought with him, with the help of his colleagues at the European Space Agency, he brought some telescopes, and he has children in Gaza watching the stars. I mean, it may sound silly, but it's important because here, you're providing them with something that says the world is bigger than our immediate problems here. That there is something bigger than us. That there is something we can work towards. We can discover something. I can show you something remarkable about us and about our stars and our universe. And I think essentially what life is about. Under difficult circumstances, one has to adapt. And this is a form of adaptation. And I go back to my biological metaphors. The environment turns bad. What species survive? It's the species that can adapt, that have the genetic diversity to be able to be selected to adapt. Not everybody adapts, unfortunately. I have cousins who are addicted to alcohol and on drugs and stuff because they cannot handle the situation. But I have others who come and you saw and they volunteer and they work with us and they enjoy life. And so that's how it is with the humans. There's variety of people. And what I try to do with this museum is provide a little bit of space, isolate them from the horrors that they see around them. And it is horrible, by the way. I mean... My master student, his cousin, was just killed. I knew his cousin. He's the number 17 I mentioned earlier, 3 days ago. He was shot in the chest, and I went to pay respect to them. This guy is very highly educated. He went to France. He actually came back from France just a week ago, a week before he got killed. And he came back because his brother was held in Israeli prison without charge for nearly 2 months now, and he's been on hunger strike for 40 days, and he thought that his brother will die. He was held for 2 years without charge or trial, so-called administrative detention. But he was on hunger strike for nearly 2 months, basically to protest being in jail without any trial or charges or seeing a lawyer or a judge or anything else. And he was worried that his brother would die in jail and he wanted to be with his family. So he came back from France and he died before his brother. So his brother is still in jail. We see things on videotape. I can show you if you want videotapes that are remarkable. I mean, just yesterday, the 3 people, I told you, 2 of the people who were killed, they planted the knives next to them. One of them is recorded on videotape that the soldier planted the knife so that they can excuse the settler shooting him. So these are horrors. And if one wants to focus on these, one cannot have a normal life. So we have to focus on something else. And this is part of the reason why I decided I cannot just keep talking about politics and trying to challenge and being arrested and all of this. As important as that is not sufficient. We also need to have a, a positive thing, a vision for the future. Rains told me this is also very important when we were talking about it in the car, that we have a vision for the future, a future of coexistence, a future of environmental conservation, a future. We have to provide a positive vision for young people especially, not just keep hammering them with the symptoms of this disease, because then we just get overwhelmed by the disease. We have to emphasize successes, and we have a lot of successes also. So come volunteer with us. We'd be happy to have you. I have two extra rooms in my house. You can stay an hour, or you can stay at the museum. There's a trailer there with four mattresses. It's not as comfortable as my house, but but you can also stay at the museum, and you can volunteer, and you can do things, and you can take the sheet of, that I gave you and pass it around, make copies of it. There's more copies here if you want to give them to your friends. And they don't have to have biology or ecology background or anything, but we could use your help even here if you want to disseminate information and work on various areas.
That's not a problem. Our last question.
How did you get that land, that beautiful land?
The land is part of Bethlehem University. It used to be actually, the building used to be a residency for the girls, for students, girls students at Bethlehem University. But since the checkpoints were created, checkpoint system and all of this stuff, and the inability of people from Gaza or from abroad to come to the university,
yeah,
I mean, you look at Boston College, you have a diversity of student body, including international students, etc. Our colleges and universities there, Bethlehem University, Ben Zeit University, I teach at both of these universities, have become essentially like a community college that's local, very local, with people just from the community. Because of the checkpoints, because of all the restrictions, etc. So they no longer needed this as a girls' dorm, if you want. And so the university gave us two floors to use in it, and the Community Partnership Institute is on the upper two floors. And the land was there, it was neglected for many, many years. And we are rehabilitating now and making it a productive botanical garden. It's about 12 dirhams, or about 4 acres, which is pretty good. So I am very optimistic we can do a very good job in it. With minimum money, a lot, but we need volunteers. We need basically buddies to work.
We have one last comment from your transportation.
Mazen, a quick question. We were talking about this in the car, a vision of the future, a positive vision of the future, what we can do here in the United States. There's been support for, growing support for the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. But in the United States, there has been no pushback yet from mainstream Americans, particularly white Americans, to the idea of Israel as a Jewish state, which Ben Netanyahu has promoted recently and everything. And so I just thought with the audience here, I would share, this is a reflection, Nadia Hejab is founder of the U.S. campaign against Israel occupation, speaking at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C., the day after Netanyahu was reelected. And she says, the very idea of Israel, the notion, the concept that you could have a Jewish state that privileges some of its people at the expense of other people, which is racist, and which has at the core of, and which has been at the core of the Zionist enterprise and Israel's formulation, and which has been hidden from Western eyes for decades, is now on full view. This concept is simply not acceptable in the 21st century. And that the idea that an ethno-nationalist Christian or Muslim or Jewish or Hindu or Buddhist, whatever thing, is that, that we do want inclusive egalitarian democracy. So this is an idea which has not been part of the conversation yet in activist circles in the United States and needs to be more so, I believe.
Well, I mean, before I came to the U.S., I was in Greece speaking at the Rhodes Forum, which is the World Public Forum, as opposed to the World Economic Forum in Davos, which, by the way, one time I actually sabotaged the World Economic Forum by having one of my articles about boycott Israel appear in their glossy magazine, and they had to actually shut down the magazine and apologize, and now they lost a huge source of revenue because I had an article in it called "The Boycott Israel" appearing in the glossy World Economic Forum. But anyway, the World Public Forum in Rhodes was discussing the future of the Middle East. And in many ways, I'm glad you brought this up, because I also want you to understand why this is relevant to you. It is not just relevant to you because, as Martin Luther King wrote from Birmingham jail, that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. It is also relevant to you because, actually, the U.S. is complicit directly, and our tax money — I'm a U.S. citizen, by the way — our tax money is used to fund this. And the U.S. veto power is used to protect Israel at the United Nations from international law. Actually, protects Israel more than it protects the United States. You know, the United States also violates international law, and they occasionally have to use the veto power to protect themselves. But they used their veto power to protect Israel actually more times than they used it to protect themselves. This is a remarkable fact, that the U.S. is very, very complicit in Israeli war crimes and crimes against humanity and all these things that are happening on the ground. And not only that, it's against U.S. public interest. It's not even for U.S. imperial interest, if you want. U.S. corporate interests are actually being affected by what Israel, what the U.S. does in the Middle East. The fact that we went to war in Iraq, that cost the U.S. taxpayers $3 trillion, with a T, by the way, $3 trillion. There's a Harvard economist that wrote a book called The $3 Trillion War. What was this war about? It was not about weapons of mass destruction or Osama bin Laden or terrorism or any of that stuff. It was not even about oil. I'm sorry to tell those of you who think it was about blood for oil, no blood for oil, because the oil companies were against the war in Iraq. It was a war for Israel, largely for Israel, because Israel thought that changing the regime in Iraq is good for Israel. They made a miscalculation, by the way. When they changed the regime in Iraq, they got strengthening of Iran, strengthening of Syria, strengthening of Hezbollah, and even the government of Iraq now turns out to be very anti-Israel. So they miscalculated. But the reason they pushed for it is because they thought it would be good for Israel, and because they lobby in Washington, pressured Congress and the U.S. president to go to war on Iraq. So these things are all related. What's happening in Syria today is very, very much connected to this. I'm happy to discuss this with any of you who want to discuss these issues. The instability in the Middle East, it's all related to this issue. It's all related to U.S. foreign policy, really, in the Middle East. Much of this foreign policy is not really U.S. foreign policy. It is written and scripted in Tel Aviv and imposed on Washington, and Washington complies. And I told this to the TSA people that were inspecting me. I said, "You're inspecting me because Washington is Israeli occupied territory." And it's true. I mean, unfortunately, I have U.S. citizenship and I have Palestinian residency because we don't have a country to call ourselves citizens of. So the two countries that I consider dear to my heart, the U.S. and Palestine, are both occupied by Israel, not one. I have two countries that are occupied by Israel, that are dear to my heart. And this is ridiculous, and it has to stop, because it's affecting your economy, it's affecting your future, the young people here, your future job prospects are being affected. The U.S. economy is being sucked dry for endless wars in the Middle East. Very few people profit from it. Halliburton and others, you know, weapons manufacturers, because they sell weapons to both sides of the Syrian war, by the way. That's who they profit. But for common people, it's very negative. I'm happy to hang around and discuss for those of you who want to hang around and talk some more.
But we'll close the official part of the event with
that. That was Professor Mazen Kumsaya speaking at Boston College about the development of a natural history museum at Bethlehem University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org or listen to us at any time via the archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. To reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.